So now this machine is on, and I welcome Frederike Lübke, who is a lecturer at SOAS, the School of Orient and African Studies, in the Hans Rosing Foundation Department for Documenting Endangered Languages.
Yes.
So please come on.
So just because we are often mixed up, I'm in the Endangered Languages Project, but within it in the Endangered Languages Academic Program, which is entirely independent of the Endangered Languages Documentation Project that hands out the big money. So, nothing to do with that. I'm on the receiving end, not on the giving end. For that one. So my title, if you've figured out the title, then I don't need to give the talk. It's Concord, Classification and Contact in Bainuk, which is an endangered language of Senegal, West Africa. And so what I'll try to do is give you a brief introduction, then focus on a very funky phenomenon, I think, literal or productive alliterative concord, or LAC, in Bainuk, and talk a bit about the importance of LAC for the nominal classification system of Bainuk and of our understanding of systems of nominal classification in general. And my second focus will be the role of contact for an understanding of this system. And finally, I violated the guidelines for the conference to only present talks on finished projects. This is actually a project that is at its very beginning. I'll try to formulate the outline of a research paradigm, and we'll invite you to help me with ideas if you have any. And although the talk focuses on a particular language, I hope that it will be of general relevance for all those of you who work in multilingual settings, because it raises general questions of what you actually have to document in these settings, whether it's just one language or the knowledge of several languages that interact with each other. So, Bainuk. Very far away from here, although it looks partly similar. You know, if you head north, you know, and you go in one of the lush valleys of Hawaii, it feels very much like Casamance, where Bainuk is spoken, in the south of Senegal. This is where it is in Africa, for those of you who work in other parts of the world. The area where it's spoken is called Casamance, and it's one of the hotspots of linguistic diversity and also language endangerment, unfortunately, in Senegal. There are roughly 20 languages spoken in the area, and that is likely to be an understatement because there have been lumping together groups of languages that resulted in minimizing the numbers. Civil war made research impossible in the past. It's only now that gradually, the area becomes accessible. And so we haven't actually had any linguistic research on languages spoken in Casamance in the last 20 years or so. The Bainuk are, as far as we know, the autochthons, or the first known inhabitants of the Casamance. Today they occupy a number of isolated villages scattered throughout the area, and they themselves group their language into three main varieties: Gunyamulo, Gubahar, and Gudyahar. I think they are more likely to be three separate languages because mutual intelligibility is very limited and there's not present-day contact. So it's more like to be an ethnonym than a really linguistic entity. The Bainuk live in a complex multilingual context where they speak between three and six languages on a daily basis, which is really the norm and not the exception in this area of Senegal and also in West Africa. Now, why is Bainuk endangered? Well, it's basically because the whole way of life is threatened. So it's not multilingualism or the confinement of Bainuk to the oral sphere or the role of the official language, French, that threaten Bainuk. This is really different to other endangerment contexts that we know in the Americas and Australia. Also, children still learn the language. But what happens is that the villages themselves gradually disappear because of massive rural exodus. And this is partly due to climate change that has a major impact on West Africa, as, you know, the Sahel stretches further further south and induces population movements. And so if people move to towns, the sole context of use of bino disappears, and people do not become monolinguals but adopt a different pattern of multilingualism in towns. So just to give you a flavor of the kind of multilingualism you find according to domains, in home, people speak mainly Bainuk, but among kids it's also very popular to speak the national lingua franca Wolof, which is really perceived as cool, modern. In the fields, there's still Bainuk, but two other contact languages come into play. On the way to town, no more Bainuk. It's Jola, Mandinka, Wolof, the national lingua franca, and French. At the market, no Bainuk. Writing, mainly in French, but to a limited extent in one Bainuk variety because of the presence of American missionaries in one of the villages. Now, you can imagine that this long-standing contact situation has had a far-reaching consequences. For instance, convergences, Sprachbund-like phenomena, in the languages spoken in the area. One example, the Bainuk word for this boat, I don't know what the English word is actually. How would you call this? No?
Canoe.
Canoe? Okay, for this canoe is Sideno. The Jola word is unrelated, it's Busana. But the canoe is made of the wood of this tree, for which I still don't know the English name either. In French it's a fromager. And so the Bainuk word is the same for the canoe and the tree, Sideno, and the same pattern you find in Jola. So this is what Ross would call metatypy. And it's really, you know, permeates the language systems. Now, what does this mean for the system of nominal classification in Bainuk? Well, as I said, there's this funky phenomenon. But let's start by having a look at the Bainuk noun class system. As not uncommon for Atlantic and Niger Congo languages in general, you'll have a stem, a nominal stem, that will then have a prefix. So if I take the stem mango, which means a concept related to mango, and add the nominal class prefix C, I get mango tree. For the plural, I use a different prefix. If I prefix bu, I get the mango fruit. Again, there's a singular plural pair here. If I add di, I get the plural. There are diminutive and augmentative prefixes. The diminutive is ko, so if I add ko to the stem mango, I get small mango, which in this case is ambiguous between mango tree and mango fruit. But you cannot stack noun class prefixes onto each other. So the diminutive prefix will replace the lexical prefixes. Now, you get approximately 20 classes, which are organized in these singular plural pairings with less plural classes than singular classes. This is fairly common for Atlantic and Niger Congo languages. And all eligible nouns, as I said, combine with diminutive and augmentative class markers. So nothing uncommon here, really. But it gets very interesting on the next slide. But just remember, for my flow of argumentation, that the diminutive prefixes replace the other class markers, so they don't co-occur with them, right? You don't get co-si-mango or co-bu-mango. Okay, now, so far so good, but there is a class of nouns in Bainuk that function rather differently. Let's take the stem fadyamen. It takes a zero prefix to mean goat. And it takes a suffix plural, fadyameng, goats. If you want to form the diminutive, you prefix ko fadyame. The plural is ko fadyame. So you get both a prefix and a suffix. Now, according to Sauvageau, who has done some work on one variety of Pinuk in the 1960s, about 30% of the nominal lexicon function this way. So they're prefixless nouns that take a suffix plural and only occur with diminutive and augmentative prefixes. Now, what about concord or agreement? If a noun has a prefix, it copies the prefix, so they have alliterative agreement on depending elements. So, si nongo, in si, this tree, mu nongo, in mu, these trees. Very neat. Again, not uncommon. What happens with the nouns that don't have a prefix, though? Well, here something really strange happens. Remember, fajamen, goat, could not be analyzed as having a prefix, right? It had a zero prefix and it took a suffix plural. Yet, you get something that looks like a class marker in agreement, because following the pattern of literal agreement, alliterative agreement, you get the first syllable of the stem copied here. Yet, this cannot be analyzed as agreement, because there's no prefix here, as you can again see when you look. Sorry, I'm getting a bit lost here. It's the time I would go to bed normally. So quite difficult to stay awake. The ko does not replace the fa, so fa cannot be analyzed as a prefix. So we have to conclude that a subset of prefixes nouns copy the first syllable of the stem onto agreeing elements. And again, recall that fa is not a class marker. Now, this is really weird because it means that we have a potentially open set of non-class markers, limited only by the initial syllables, the number of initial syllables of the language. Literal alliterative concord, or productive or radical alliterative concord, as it has sometimes been labeled, is also noteworthy because it challenges theories of grammar that assume the principle of phonology-free syntax, where syntactic processes like agreement cannot recur to phonology. Maybe not surprisingly, therefore, LAC is cross-linguistically extremely rare. It has only been postulated for less than a handful of languages worldwide, among them Pinuk. But most of the evidence is really doubtful and very limited. This holds also for Pinuk, where we have two papers of Sauvageau that only give three examples, although they make far-reaching claims. Now, one thing, although despite the limited evidence, we can also already say, literal alliterative concord in Pinuk is not unconstrained. Only a subset of prefixless nouns exhibits it. The others take kind of default agreement suffixes that are no and in the plural vowel and no. Now, I said that LAC can only be understood in the multilingual binary context. Why? Well, because there's a first hypothesis uttered by Sauvageau that says that prefixless nouns are loanwords. And again, we cannot substantiate his claims because he doesn't give us the examples. But according to Sauvageau, the majority of prefixless nouns are loanwords, mainly from Mandinka, a Manda language. And Manda languages don't have noun classes. Sauvageau also claims that the suffix definite marker that you've seen on the examples that exist only in the Gunyamla variety of Pinuk, and the plural, the suffix plural, are borrowed from Mandinka as well. However, the evidence is not quite straightforward because suffix plurals are also attested in the closely related language Bui, according to Deneux, 1991. And Bui has been less in contact with Mandinka. And suffix class markers are also attested in several Atlantic languages alongside or instead of prefixes. Actually, Atlantic languages are quite famous for having prefixes and suffixes, or both, constituting different stages in a process of renewal of non-class markers. So, well, is there an answer to the puzzle of, you know, how does alliterative concord come about? Not quite, but there are some indices, and they point to a very complicated process. So let's return to our goat, Fadiamin. Fadiamin is also tested in, has a cognate in Jola. Jola is also not only the main contract language, but also a closely related language of the Atlantic branch of Niger Congo. In Jola, goat is Ejamen, E being the class mark in the singular, Sijamen in the plural. I mean, I kind of assume that this is a borrowing from Jola, but the evidence is, again, not really clear. The question then is, okay, if Bainuk took Ejamen, Sijamen, where does the far come from? It's not part of the Jola word. Now, there is a form, Febi, that means goat, in Bainuk Ubahar, another Bainuk writing, and an archaic form, Febi, for goat, in Guniamulu, that is not used anymore. And Fa is also a non-class prefix that is attested in other Atlantic languages, among them the close related Bui. So the hypothesis at the moment is that literal alliterative concord comes about through the combination of etymological knowledge of the speakers and borrowing. So it's a kind of form of loan blending. You take a stem from another language and you just put an archaic non-class prefix on it. So they are prefixes that are not quite prefixes anymore. It's as if the Bainuk speakers are all historical linguists. Now, as I said, I haven't really done the research yet to decipher this system, but what I will try to do over the next 3 years is look at literal alliterative concord in Bainuk in more detail. And that means, first of all, inclusion of data from all three varieties of Bainuk, an establishment of an inventory of nouns with agreement properties in all varieties and the contact languages, some of which are not or not well described, and crucially, a combination of social linguistic data with linguistic data in order to determine plausibility and direction of borrowing, because this is a huge methodological problem, especially regarding the closely related contact languages, Jola and Bainuk. Another task I've been thinking about is use Swadesh lists. I know they're out of fashion, but recently McMahon and McMahon have used them because we all know that Swadesh lists contain loan words, and they have created sublists, the high-high and low-low sublists, that robustly across Indo-European languages contain the least and the most loan words. So it should be possible to use them as kind of heuristic tools in order to determine whether which items of the basic vocabulary are loans or not. In addition, I plan to conduct experiments comprising naming tasks for novel objects, definition, classification, sorting, and word creation tasks, accompanied by the elicitation of concord data. And just, if I may just show you two slides to give you an example of that, then I'm finished. So, for instance, I've done a social linguistic study with 32 participants from 2 Bainuk villages, and I plan to extend this. And already we can see a pattern of change in multilingual profiles over time. So the over 46-year-olds all speak Bainuk, all speak Jola. The under 18-year-olds all speak Bainuk, but speak less Jola, and less Mandinka and more Wolof and more French. So, you know, and the use of social linguistic data like these will hopefully allow to determine the plausibility of borrowing scenarios depending on the domains of use for the borrowed, or the candidates for borrowing. Naming and sorting tasks, like used by Seifert and Sanya, where consultants name tasks and you then elicit the agreement properties of the items used. Other tasks, for instance, making up novel words. Is a buguso A, an instrument for cutting, B, a fruit, C, a body part? Now, according to my preliminary knowledge of the binary noun class system, it could be either B or C, because it has the prefix B that is used for many circular objects like fruit, but also for body parts that are circular. Mm-hmm. Okay. Or Kamun means steering wheel. I made up a novel word. How do we say this steering wheel? Would it be Kamun Inka or Kamun Inno? Invent a binary word for window, etc. Now, if you have more ideas, I would be grateful for them. And this is time for me to finish.
Thank you very much. Questions, comments? Yes, please.
Does that mean that in the world, religious world, it's not that when people are speaking as a moral leader, that you're not doing this?
There are, is no monolingual variety. Yes, yes, but I didn't say that they're monolingual communities. So, but they're just, if they shift to cities, they lose Binuk and they speak other languages that they already speak in the rural context, and they acquire new languages as well that they need in that context. It's happening there as well. But it's an interesting point, really, because what I didn't mention is that there is an important diaspora in towns. And actually, these are the people also behind the movement for the revitalization, maintenance of Binuk. And so the question really is, to what extent do you include them in the documentation? And also, from an empirical point of view, now, what will the differences be? Because they are, again, in contact with other languages, with noun class systems, so you know, you're likely to have other convergences and interferences.
You said that you want any ideas of maybe test these ideas you had and to see, you know, the agreement. I worked on a Nigerian language, Asan, and when our consultant speaks on the phone with family, she speaks in Asan, Pidgin, and English all at the same time, all switching back and forth seamlessly. And she says that's how our family speaks.
Yes.
And there's no agreement in ASAN, but I think that if they do lots of code switching in this language, which I assume if they do, given the multilingual setting, that oftentimes they will incorporate maybe a single French word or a single world word.
Yes.
And that maybe that you could see how that fits into the grammatical system of a pure form, even if there is one, and see how that fits into the grammar.
Yes, I mean, again, I didn't have time in this talk, but this is one of the reasons why I want to link social linguistic and linguistic data, because I think in this context, what I need is to identify domains where there is the least contact, you know, because in theories of multilingualism, for instance, Grosjean has this pattern or this model where a multilingual speaker have different modes, a monolingual mode and multilingual modes, depending on whether they speak to other monolinguals or to multilinguals with whom they share a language, etc. And I think in multilingual contexts like this, it also depends on the conventions for language use. Just like we have registers, you know, in a monolingual settings, we will have conventions on which languages to use in this setting. And so there are likely to be different modes. And I think it's important to identify those modes and to, you know, use these data in order to interpret linguistic data. Like find more monolingual binuk modes and modes with more interference, and that will also help, you know, for instance, to identify code switching and differentiate from borrowing, etc. And we all know the methodological problems associated with that.
I found this example in Finland very interesting, and you said that this farm is only found in archive for, I mean, dialects or another more conservative.
I'm not sure whether the other variety is more conservative, because I'm not that far yet in my research. But so in the variety that I've worked on, it's the archaic word. And I came, you know, it's only because we went to another village, collected the word for goat, and I brought it back to the village. Do you know that word, Phoebe? That, oh, yes, we used to have that. So that's Why I concluded it's archaic in Gunyamulo.
But you said that the explanation was very difficult to explain in that way, that we suppose that the speakers would have historical...
Well, in a way, I mean, you know, because in order to do that, you take, I mean, if you borrow, you know, you take a word, right, you strip it of its non-class prefix, and you put another prefix in front of it. I think that's quite remarkable, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And I think this is what Coserio, for example, used to say that about the diachronic knowledge that
speakers
have, actually, their language.
And in Wolof, this a similar phenomenon is attested. It doesn't go as far, because people use different noun classes for stylistic differences. And so any given noun can have three different noun class prefixes. Among them, there can be a literal. So you can have literal. So Wolof doesn't have noun class markers anymore, so you only have agreement, right? So, but, and literal agreement is not productive in the language except for stylistic reasons. But people do not just copy anything, only those initial syllables that actually correspond to attested noun classes in the language. That's quite an intricate knowledge that speakers have, right, in order to be able to do that.
One more question, please.
I'm wondering if you had any considerations of studying the Banuke and being in the South.
That's difficult, because when I was in Casamance last year, I wasn't even able to go to the villages close to the border. It's still a no-go area, because, you know, there has been a secessionist civil war going on in Casamance for the past 20 years, and the rebels are still operating out of Guinea-Bissau. And, well, they survived just for, you know, purely economic reasons, so they have hold-ups, and they still take hostages. So they had a big hold-up while I was there and robbed, I think, 40 cars in one day. And so it's still pretty dangerous to go to that area. And it's also pretty difficult, therefore, to go to Guinea-Bissau from Casamance. And so that will, you know, just have to be decided during the next field trip and will depend on safety considerations.
I visited one of three
Have you?
Communities
Yes.
there.
When?
In 07.
Okay, really?
Late 07, yes.
Oh, that's great. I'll have to talk to you.
Okay. Yeah.
Yes.
I'm curious.
What is the
conference?
Yes.
And
let us thank the lady. So next speaker, is he or she already here? Yeah, so please come forward. So you are the next speaker, and you have is there a computer?
Yes.
Oh.
It's
Otherwise it's a bit hard. Are we just grabbing the four days?
There you go.
Thank you.